Headlines: Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal meet in Vienna for a new round of talks on reviving the international accord. Russia says actions by the U.S. and the NATO military alliance in Europe are increasing the threat of a military confrontation. And protesters take to the streets in the U.S. state of North Carolina for a fifth day after the police fatal shooting of a black man last week. Welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal resume negotiations in Vienna to revive the troubled accord. The Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi is leading Iran's delegation in discussions with France, Germany, Britain, Russia, and China. The diplomatic effort began in early April and is being coordinated by the European Union. All sides have described as constructive their previous meetings. The talks are aimed at making practical arrangements required for the U.S. return to the nuclear deal. Iran wants all sanctions imposed by the U.S. after its 2018 withdrawal to be removed at once. Araghchi has warned that Iran will walk out of the talks if it finds them long drawn out. The Iranian Parliament's Research Center has called for the complete removal of all sanctions against the Islamic Republic. In a new report, the center assessed that the ongoing talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna with the aim of reviving the accord. The center strongly rejected any partial sanctions removal. They said accepting a U.S. proposal in this regard would limit Iran's benefits from the deal because Washington may levy new sanctions citing non-nuclear pretext. The research center concluded that all sanctions targeting different Iranian sectors or individuals have to be removed so that the JCPOA and its benefits can truly materialize for Iran. A prominent international rights group says Israel's persecution of Palestinians amounts to crimes against humanity and crimes of apartheid. Human Rights Watch says examples of Israel's apartheid policies are its restrictions on Palestinians' movements and the seizure of their land for illegal settlements. The rights group has called on the International Criminal Court to investigate and to prosecute Israeli officials over the persecution of Palestinians. Several weeks ago, the court said that it would investigate war crimes against the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Israel has fully closed the Gaza Strip fishing zone, banning Palestinians from sailing off the coast of the besieged territory. Israel says the closure is in response to rocket attacks from Gaza and has ordered its military to prepare for any scenario. The closure has made things even harder for the Palestinians amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
The Israeli violation of the rights of Palestinians does not seem to abate. In the latest development, the regime fully closed Gaza's fishing zone, preventing Palestinians from sailing off the besieged enclave. Israeli authorities said the total closure was in response to rocket attacks from the Gaza Strip. They said five rockets were fired from Gaza at Israel overnight. But the decision comes as fishing is a significant source of income for many Gazans. The size of the fishing zone has varied over the years. It was set at 20 nautical miles by the Oslo Peace Accord in the 1990s before being reduced to 6 miles under the joint Israeli-Egyptian blockade in 2007. This, as a measure, is not enough for doing any fishing in the first place. But the Israeli regime has raised and lowered the limit several times in recent years in a bid to pressure the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas.
Israeli policy towards Gazans and their fishing industry has long been part of their plan to periodically crush Gazans and to keep the economy on life supports. I think we also have to look at the current situation in the framing of what's going on in Israel, that there is recently been an election, that Netanyahu is trying to put together a group of cohorts that will create a majority in the Knesset, and that he will often create military issues or heighten military tensions in order to increase his popularity and to get people to rally around him. So I think it's a combination of their longstanding policies and the current situation in the electorate in Israel.
The decision to fully shut the fishing zone to the Palestinians comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called for the military to prepare for any scenario regarding the Gaza Strip. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz also echoed Netanyahu's remarks, saying Israeli forces will do whatever necessary to, quote, preserve calm.
The closure of the Gaza fishing zone comes amid the territory's struggle with an Israeli blockade in place for 14 years now, entering its 15th year. The blockade has taken its toll on employment in Gaza, where jobless rates is among the highest in the world. The rate more than doubled last year from 23.6% in 2005. Now there are concerns that the situation would get worse following the Israeli closure of the Gaza fishing zone.
Israel's closure of the fishing zone limits what little the blockaded territory has for its food supplies. According to figures, there are some 4,000 fishermen registered in the Gaza Strip who are breadwinners of some 50,000 people. This, however, is something misleading, as half of those registered are actually out of work. 95% of Gaza fishermen population lives under the poverty line. Many of them rely on humanitarian aid and belong to the 80% of Gaza's overall population who rely on such aid. But the closure of the fishing zone is not the only nightmare the Palestinians live with. The Israeli regime has put nearly 3 million people under a tight land, sea, and air blockade since 2007, bringing almost the entire population to starvation. The blockade targets Gaza's vital infrastructure, including water, energy, health, and other sectors, complicating the already dire humanitarian situation there. Gaza's health sector, for instance, is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies. Many believe this is itself a war crime in its own form and must be stopped.
So the issue of whether the behavior of the Israeli government and military comprise various war crimes is one that has been debated and exposed repeatedly. And there are now questions in front of the International Criminal Court. And I think that they will obviously come up with an opinion themselves. Personally, I find much of the behavior of the Israeli government and the military towards the 2.2 million Gazans can be characterized as various kinds of war crimes.
Meanwhile, the blockade has exacerbated further with COVID-19 ravaging the Gaza Strip. This brings to the spotlight the fact that the blockade and sufferings of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are going unnoticed.
Well, the Gazans have long been invisible on the world stage. Many of us have tried to highlight the exacerbations of the humanitarian catastrophe in view of the COVID-19 pandemic. But it's part of a longstanding pattern of valuing Jewish Israeli lives over the lives of Palestinians living in Gaza. And I think this is a combination of both medical apartheid and racism and Islamophobia and forces like that that shape international opinion.
What is questionable, however, is that the international community must have a role in bringing Palestinian sufferings to an end, and humanitarian efforts must gain momentum to get the blockade lifted. This includes international legal bodies like the International Criminal Court, which can play a key role in calling Israel to account over its decades-long crimes against the Palestinian people.
The recent military gains by Yemeni army, backed by allied fighters from popular committees in its battle for the strategic city of Ma'arib, have forced the Saudi-led coalition to adopt new desperate measures to keep the city under its control. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
Amid the continued advancement of the Yemeni army in the city of Ma'arib, the Saudi-led coalition has begun to build new military camps in Shabwa and al-Wadi'a areas to deploy more troops in the city.
What the Saudi-led coalition has in mind by building new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas shows that the coalition is losing the control of Ma'arib. It is now desperately trying to keep the city under its control, but the Yemeni army is determined to liberate all Yemeni lands.
The latest measures by Saudi-led coalition in Ma'arib comes after Yemeni army backed by allied fighters from popular committees took control of strategic areas, including Tum al-Ulya Hill, which is 4 kilometers away from the western neighborhoods of the city of Ma'arib.
Al-Tuma Al-Awliya Hill has a great military and strategic importance as it can provide the Yemeni army with a good opportunity to achieve its military goals. The hill overlooks the city of Marib, so the Yemeni army will be able to target the enemy inside the city.
The Yemeni army has also intensified its retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Earlier, Yemeni troops launched an attack with a drone of Qasif K2 against King Khalid Airbase in Asir in retaliation for the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Yemenis say their army will continue its operations to liberate all the Yemeni lands, including the oil-rich province of Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Russia has accused the U.S. and its NATO allies in Europe of contributing to an increased military threat in the region with their actions.
The growth of military threat is fueled by the activities of the United States and NATO in the European region. They increase the combat readiness of troops and strengthen their presence.
The Russian defense minister criticized NATO for deploying its modern military infrastructure and carrying out operational combat training in Europe. Shoigu also warned that nationalistic sentiments being fueled in Ukraine could further provoke military conflict in the Donbas region. He said that Moscow would act if it realizes it is necessary to ensure security at its borders. Tensions are running high between Russia and NATO countries following Moscow's military buildup along the border with Ukraine earlier this month. That after reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russia forces in Donbas. Ukraine, the U.S., and NATO accused Russia of propping up militias in eastern Ukraine, which Moscow denies. Protesters have taken to the streets in Elizabeth City, in the U.S. state of North Carolina, for a fifth straight day. They are angry at the fatal police shooting of a black man there last week. The protesters demanded the public release a video from the body-worn camera of a sheriff's deputy who gunned down Andrew Brown. Attorneys for the Brown family have said that body camera footage showed that he had been, quote, executed. They've accused officials of withholding evidence. The lawyers say that Brown had his hands on the steering wheel of his car when multiple deputies began firing at him in his driveway in Elizabeth City. They say the deputies continue to shoot even though Brown posed no threat. Colin Campbell explains why attorneys believe Andrew Brown posed no threat to police officers when he was shot.
From indications, it appears that Brown was shot in the back of his head, and attorneys say that his hands were still on the steering wheel when he was shot. So this could indicate that the person was trying to comply while he was being shot. It could show that he was trying to drive away when he was shot. There's still a lot that needs to be investigated, but it has shown, at least from what attorneys are saying, that this was not a very clean type of, obviously not a clean arrest, but not a clean shooting either. It was not a very clear case, and it looks like there was some obfuscation there and some cause for concern, as the bullet appears to be in the back of Brown's head, not in the front where he would be more of a threat to police. So I think that's why a lot of people want to see this video and why it's being heavily scrutinized.
India's new daily COVID cases have stayed above 300,000 for a sixth day in a row. The country recorded over 323,000 new cases in the past 24 hours. That was below a Monday worldwide peak of over 352,000. India's total COVID cases now top 17.6 million, the second largest in the world. This total deaths are nearly 198,000. The virus surge in India has caused a shortage of beds and oxygen supplies. That has forced hospitals to turn away patients. The army has pledged urgent medical aid to help tackle the crisis. Several countries have also promised aid and assistance. Iran has reported nearly 21,000 new coronavirus infections and 462 more related deaths in the past 24 hours. The figure provided by the Iranian Health Ministry now pushes the country's total caseload to 2.4 million. The total death toll is also now over 70,000. According to the ministry, over 1.9 million patients have so far recovered from the disease. Meanwhile, health officials have warned the number of fatalities could rise in the next 2 weeks. Iran has seen a rapid surge in infections since late March, which is largely blamed on more contagious strains and New Year's travels. Stringent restrictions are now in place in more than 300 cities across the country to curb the spread of the virus. The government of UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been rocked by accusations of impropriety over highly inflammatory comments regarding a third national lockdown, as well as the origins of the funds used to refurbish the Prime Minister's residence. The grilling of Britain's most senior civil servants by MPs to explain Johnson's actions has left the political establishment querying how Boris Johnson can survive the latest round of the sleaze to Raqqa's administration.
The UK's most senior civil servant, Simon Case, found himself in the hot seat, fending off increasingly more awkward accusations that were being levelled against Prime Minister Boris Johnson, including a leaked claim that the Prime Minister said he would, quote, rather see bodies piled high in their thousands than order third lockdown. On a factory tour, the Prime Minister was emphatic in his denial and instead attempted to shift the narrative.
No, but again, I think the important thing I think people want to us to get on and do as a government is to make sure that the lockdowns work.
Simon Case says an investigation into another of the more serious allegation that the Prime Minister used private donor funds to refurbish his official residence is now ongoing. But the main opposition Labour Party wants a full electoral commission inquiry to uncover all the facts.
And it's all very well the Prime Minister saying, well, say now, well, I'm paying for it. The critical question was, what was the original arrangement? And why is it so complicated? If there's a straightforward answer, well, give it. And if there isn't, then there are very serious questions to be asked.
Pressure is mounting on Johnson to give a full account of his actions as these new claims follow other accusations of cronyism and improper lobbying, with the Prime Minister's former aide Dominic Cummings launching a blistering attack on his integrity. But according to analysts, British politics and political favours have always operated on a nod, a wink and a handshake.
Up until very recently, those deals were concealed. There wasn't much public access to what was going on or any accountability. I think it raises questions about our democracy.
Those hoping that this latest political scandal may mark the beginning of the end of Boris Johnson's premiership may be left disappointed. After all, this wily political cat has shown he's more than capable of using all nine of his allocated lives. Whether he stays or if he goes is now in the hands of his colleagues.
You must stay.
With the country focused on COVID recovery, Johnson, his government and associates will be all too aware that the worst could yet be still to come. Amina Taylor, London.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. Internal obstacles. The path ahead is clear for us, and the obstacles are also clear for the Iranian nation. You must overcome these obstacles. Both the internal obstacles and the external ones. The internal obstacles can be overcome by supplication to God, prayer, attention to God, self-edification, and reinforcing morals. If our hearts are not purified, we will not be able to build a correct world. If we are defective inside, we cannot fix a defective society and a defective world. The Iranian nation has a great responsibility that has to be fulfilled. They have to build a wonderful world both for themselves and for other societies. You can do it, but only if each and every one of us works on self-edification. Praying attentively, reciting Quran, prayer and supplication, fasting in Ramadan, and not prayers, especially for the youth who are more receptive, can be self-edifying.
فيك الحب زاد عم العباد يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
One hour in seclusion. Pray. Stand up the night in prayers. Contemplate. Be attentive by dhikr. Spend an hour between yourself and God. Put different occupations aside and get closer to God, God's friend, and Imam al-Mahdi, God hasten his reappearance. Get closer to Quran and reflect on it. Mosque as a base. Establish brotherly ties with the Imam of your mosque, the worshippers at the mosque, and the believers who visit the mosque, and safeguard and fortify those ties. Stand up in prayer at the earliest time, in congregation, in any mosque you find yourself in. Attend religious gatherings at mosques. Attend Quran and dua recitation sessions. Make mosques more attractive.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iran.
The wholly occupied city of Jerusalem al-Quds has seen regular clashes over the past week between Palestinian residents and Israeli military forces who have been blocking Palestinians from sitting on the steps of Damascus Gate. This is while thousands of Palestinians traditionally sit in the area following nighttime prayers during the holy Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. On Thursday, the Israeli regime forces attacked Palestinians who gathered outside of the Damascus Gate on the north side of the occupied old city of Jerusalem al-Quds. That ignited protests against restrictions on their Palestinians' gatherings in Jerusalem al-Quds old city during the fasting month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians were injured at the Damascus Gate of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds as Palestinian activists confronted hundreds of far-right and extremist Israeli settlers chanting death to Arabs in their rally in the center of the occupied city. Palestinian protesters, angered by chants of death to Arabs from far-right Jewish demonstrators, clashed repeatedly with Israeli police. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said in a statement that at least 105 Palestinians were injured, including 22 people who were hospitalized. Also, Israeli forces arrested at least 50 Palestinians during the clashes. The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas denounced the violence against Palestinians, saying that he holds the Israeli regime accountable for this serious deterioration. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has denounced Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds, expressing its solidarity with the victims. Meanwhile, dozens of rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip towards Israel in alliance with protesters in al-Quds. Israeli media said that the Palestinian resistance movement fired 36 rockets toward the occupied territories. Israeli authorities claimed that most of the rockets had struck open areas, while only six of the projectiles had been intercepted by the Iron Dome missile defense system. Israel responded by carrying out airstrikes across the besieged coastal sliver.
I think what's going on is that there has been a continuation of violence, state violence, by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinians, against the indigenous people. And it is the latest chapter, if you like, of what's actually been going on in terms of that. And this idea of the Zionists trying to take over that land, take over that place, is something that is continuing unabated. And it is something that needs to be recognized for what it is that they are actually doing.
Israel lays claim to the entire Jerusalem al-Quds, but the international community views the city's eastern sector as occupied territory, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state. According to the UN Security Council Resolution 478, other member states are prohibited from establishing diplomatic missions in Jerusalem al-Quds. The resolution states that the Council does not recognize Jerusalem al-Quds as the occupying Israeli regime's capital. Palestinians who seek an independent state in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, with East Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital, have condemned the U.S. pro-Israel agenda. During the former U.S. President Donald Trump, Israel stepped up its settlement expansion in defiance of the U.N. Security Council Resolution 2334. According to the resolution, settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds are illegal. Also, several countries, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, normalized their relations with the Israeli regime by signing the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. All of them are illegal under international law, for they were built on occupied land.
Unless there is a reality check, and unless there is something done to recognize the oppression that the Israelis are carrying out on that occupied land, nothing is going to change. There is going to be no peace without justice being served.
Israel has made it a priority to change the demographics of Jerusalem al-Quds and Judaize the city slowly but surely. While Palestinians are the rightful owners of Jerusalem al-Quds, and the international community is against the Israeli regime's illegal settlements, there have not been any moves to stop Israel from advancing its plans.
From drones to missiles,
Iran's been enhancing its military and defense capabilities by employing and testing homegrown state-of-the-art technologies. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently released footage portraying the country's latest advancements in the field of drone technology. The footage captured by IRGC drones shows close-up shots of an American aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. The Defense Force also released a video that showed its kamikaze drones hitting their targets with surgical accuracy. Meanwhile, the head of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees the American forces stationed in the West Asia region, revealed to the U.S. Congress that Iranian drone power has stripped the American Air Force of what the commander called its upper hand in the world. General McKenzie made the comments in written testimony to the House Armed Services Committee, in which he noted how Washington was daunted by Iran's far and wide application of small and medium-sized drones for surveillance and attacks. The top general said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region.
This is something that is going to be very troubling to U.S. government officials because they certainly don't want anybody to have major power except for themselves and some of their allies such as Israel in the Middle East. But as far as the U.S. finally conceding that its power is limited, it's going to take a long time for them to actually recognize that, to face that reality. They're going to work hard to overcome it, spending more money than they already spend on the military. And right now, the U.S. spends more on its military than the next 10 nations combined. So it's going to be another kind of arms race, and it will not have a good outcome at all. But hopefully the United States will at some point turn its attentions elsewhere into some other area, either of the world or looking more closely at its own internal problems.
Iran's military says the capabilities have enabled it to nip any security threat in the bud.
I am announcing today that
tensions between Iran and the United States escalated after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew Washington from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign, reinstating sanctions against Tehran and ramping up its military presence in the West Asia region. What happened following the move has been regarded as a test of strength for Iran, not only economically, but also militarily. One instance proving Iran's military advancements occurred on June 20, 2019, when Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps shot down an intruding United States RQ-4A Global Hawk spying drone with a surface-to-air missile over the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has repeatedly said its military capabilities are merely for the defensive purposes and has called for regional cooperation to ensure peace in the Persian Gulf region. In this regard, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani presented a plan dubbed the Hormuz Peace Initiative, or HOPE, which aims at establishing long-term peace in the region, an issue that Iran says is impossible as long as outsiders are present.
This will happen eventually. More and more nations will see that they can rely on Iran. Iran has the strength, Iran has the will, and Iran is looking for peace in the Middle East. The United States is not looking for peace in the Middle East. It has no interest in peace in the Middle East, which is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, why the Iranian government will not work with the United States. Iran is a force to be reckoned with, and the United States has just recognized that in a major way.
But what does the U.S. recognition of Iran's military power amid its waning presence in the region mean for Washington? Only time can tell.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it routinely launches airstrikes against targets in Syria. It is also widely blamed for high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran. The regime is believed to have carried out the recent sabotage attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear facility, which operates under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran was quick to pledge to retaliate for the attack on Natanz. Tel Aviv apparently knows no limit when it comes to clandestine operations against other countries. The regime always says it carries out such actions out of worries for its own security. Such dangerous policies could be starting to backfire. This week, a sensitive missile factory in central Israel was rocked by a powerful blast. The huge explosion, which created a mushroom cloud, hit the Tomer factory for advanced weapons. Israeli officials say the blast was a test. On Thursday, a missile fired from Syria landed near the secretive Dimona nuclear weapons facility, triggering warning sirens. The Israeli military said the projectile was a surface-to-air missile fired by Syrian forces against Israeli warplanes. It says the projectile overflew its target and landed near Dimona. But the heavily protected nuclear facility is some 300 kilometers south of Damascus. It is a very long distance for an errant missile. The missile fired from Syria on Thursday landed just some 30 kilometers away from the notorious Israeli nuclear facility. Military experts say this has once again revealed that much-trumpeted Israeli air defenses are penetrable. The projectile made it through the air defense layers despite the fact that anti-aircraft and anti-missile systems around Dimona have been significantly boosted in anticipation of a possible retaliatory missile or drone attack by Iran or resistance groups close to Iran.
By looking at this particular site, Dimona, where this weapon nearly hit, it's saying, well, if you really want to have some sort of fight, you do realise that your nuclear facilities, we know exactly where they are, and they could be hit too. And I'm afraid just simply repeating the lies about the impenetrability of the Israeli air defences and missile defences is not going to save anybody in a conflict. It's really just hot air.
Israeli media, like the Times of Israel, have highlighted the fact that the missile landed deep inside Israel amid heightened tensions with Iran and after Tehran's pledge of retaliation. Some other media organizations, like the Middle East Monitor, said Netanyahu's comments after the attack on Natanz looked like a claim of responsibility, and this may have pushed Iran to retaliate. Israel seems increasingly worried about the possibility of the United States removing sanctions against Iran to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal that America abandoned under former President Donald Trump. Israel has always been a vociferous critic of the deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for possible repercussions for the region and beyond.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are holding talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, trying to salvage the accord. The 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been at crisis ever since the United States left the pact unilaterally in 2018 and imposed sanctions against Iran. While Tehran's precondition for returning to compliance is removal of all U.S. sanctions, Washington has so far refrained from doing so. U.S. media have cited a source close to America's top nuclear negotiator, Robert Malley, in Vienna, as saying that Washington is opposed to removal of all sanctions imposed on Iran. Current U.S. officials and sources close to American and European negotiators have now been saying that the U.S. is dividing the post-JCPOA sanctions into JCPOA-related and non-JCPOA-related ones, and intends to remove only the former. The presence of numerous Iranian names on the United States specially designated nationals and blocked persons list, even if apparently unimportant individuals, would also sharply restrict the ceiling for Iran's benefits from the JCPOA. Iran wants these names to also be removed. Iran, meanwhile, is saying that it considers all those sanctions as JCPOA-related because they were imposed with the intent to affect the deal and its implementation, or most recently, the negotiations to revive it. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, says Tehran is proposing a logical path to the U.S. for its full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. He called on the U.S. to return to full compliance first, and then Iran will reciprocate after rapid verification of Washington's compliance. Zarif also stressed that all sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump must be removed. The main sanctions were imposed on Iran's oil and banking sectors. Speaking to Press TV, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The Iranian diplomat also rejected the idea of a step-by-step return to the nuclear accord.
Well, certainly there are sanctions that were imposed under the Trump administration separate from the JCPOA that were designed to make it more difficult for the Biden administration to get back into the deal. But the Biden administration had time before it came into the White House, and now it's been 3 months. They have had the time to figure out how to lift those sanctions that were not related to the JCPOA.
During the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump, Washington unilaterally left the JCPOA. Trump reimposed a series of expansive sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the deal, this time not under the pretext of concerns about Iran's nuclear program, which the JCPOA had already addressed, but under new labels, for instance, so-called sponsorship for terrorism. However, Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, has already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. He said Washington is seeking to achieve a mutual return to compliance with the nuclear deal. While the U.S. seems to try to use the sanctions as leverage in the negotiations on the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran has made it clear that it will only return to its commitments under the accord once it has verified that all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled U.S. sanctions against Tehran are removed.
Certainly, if there are remaining sanctions that are having an impact on the Iranian bank, for example, that makes it hard to have transactions with not only the U.S., but countries all over the world, that is problematic. If there continue to be sanctions that make other companies in countries outside the U.S. Worried about doing business with Iran because they continue to be afraid that they will be sanctioned by the United States, that is problematic. And so the U.S. really has to lift all of these sanctions because they are interconnected.
Iran is articulating what should happen in order for the deal to be revived in its original form. By refusing to listen, the United States and Europe are only making it more difficult for the prospect to materialize.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Q&A and Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer questions, doubts, or misconceptions which are being asked or are sent to this radio station with regard to Islamic theology. For this, we try to invite Islamic scholars and speakers from Qom Seminary schools. Like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to help us with his answer to the questions which are going to be asked concerning the holy month of Ramadan. The questions that we have and we shall pose and talk about are mostly in this very session about the holy month of Ramadan. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
The question of the day actually is the continuation of the question that was posed in our last show. So that's why we try to, inshallah ta'ala, continue to talk about and discuss that question again. And what was the question? The question was, what is a good plan or the best plan? What do you recommend for the rest of the days and months that we have in year to be benefited from the blessings of the holy month of Ramadan? So we have only one golden month where Allah's blessings and bounties are showered on His beliefs, on His creatures. Now, how can we actually store these positive energy for the rest of the year? This was the question, and Sheikh Murtada Karimi, Islamic scholar, actually touched upon this issue to some extent, but we left the whole answer to be given and presented to you today. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome. We are listening to you, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned in the previous program, if we want to continue acting upon what we gain in the holy month of Ramadan, first we need to know what we can gain during this holy month. I mentioned that according to the verse of chapter Baqarah, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, reaching taqwa and God-weariness is the main purpose for fasting. And in a narration from the Holy Prophet, reads that the best action during the holy month of Ramadan is to be away from maharim Allah, the forbidden actions. Now, there are some other spiritual things that we can gain during the holy month of Ramadan, and then we can have a program for keeping them after the holy month of Ramadan. One of them is the fact that through fasting during the holy month of Ramadan, we are able to be much more careful about the day of judgment. Mm-hmm. In one narration, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, وَذْكُرُوا بِجُوعِكُمْ وَعْتَشِكُمْ فِيهِ جُوعَ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ جُوعَ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ وَعْتَشَ. So as people being involved during the year in worldly affairs, we may not think about the Day of Judgment a lot, which is very unfortunate. But during the holy month of Ramadan, one of the spiritual gains is that according to this narration, the Holy Prophet says, through your hunger and thirst, remember your thirst and hunger on the Day of Judgment. So this is another spiritual lesson that we can gain during the holy month of Ramadan.
Very true.
Doing ihsan or benevolence, we know that the holy month of Ramadan is the month of paying charity and sadaqah. There are, many narrations about the virtues of giving ihsan, charity, sadaqah during the holy month of Ramadan. We can practice it during the holy month of Ramadan. It can become a habit for us, and then we can continue acting upon that after the holy month of Ramadan. The next point is taking benefit from the dawns from the Sahar during the holy month of Ramadan. Let me share some sentences mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He says that in this busy world, if we are not able to take benefit from the time of Sahar or dawn, we do not have any other time to have a privacy for ourselves, for our heart, with our God. There is no other time. We are busy. We are busy. In 24 hours, a couple of hours, we are sleeping. In the times that we are awake, every person has a worldly, some worldly affairs. So Ayatollah Khamenei continues to say that in the past, we had some opportunities to have such free time, but today, this is the force of the time. We have some new phenomena which were not there in the past. So according to Ayatollah Khamenei, the only time that we can have a privacy for ourselves and for our hearts between us and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is during Sahar or dawn. Now, because of the fact that many Muslims, they get awake before dawn to eat suhoor, again, it can become a habit for the believers to continue to do that. Mm-hmm. So taking benefit from this time is a gracious blessing of the holy month of Ramadan. But many people, unfortunately, from the day of Eid al-Fitr, they continue to get awake after Adhan al-Sawab to say the morning prayer. But it would be great if people can practice that during the holy month of Ramadan. And
wake up before Adhan.
Exactly, and to make it into a habit, doing tahajjud, night vigil. There are many stories, many statements by the great scholars about the virtues of night vigil. Maybe 10 minutes before Fajr, Adhan, it would be great. And gradually people can increase the time, inshallah. So it is one of the great blessings of the holy month of Ramadan. The next point is reciting the Quran. Again, many Muslims, they do that during the holy month of Ramadan. We know that many people are able, through the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to do a khatm, to recite one juz every day, so that at the end of the month they are able to read and recite the whole noble book of Quran. For 30 days we are practicing that. Again, we can turn it and change it into a habit. Not one juz every day, at least 50 verses according to some narrations. If not able, one page, two pages. We need to have this connection to the noble book of Quran. Ikhlas or sincerity is another spiritual...
So the next recommendation was to have this constant relation with the Holy Quran, recitation of the Holy Quran.
Yes.
So as it has been recommended to recite at least 50 verses of the Holy Quran per day, at least in other days. While in the Holy Month of Ramadan, we should not suffice with even one juz of it.
It depends. Although, if people have the time, we have about the scholars. For the imams of the Ahlul Bayt, for the Prophet, we have in the narrations that they used to, do the khatm of the Quran several times during the holy month of Ramadan. We have the same stories about some of the great scholars. But maybe we can say, of course, this isn't a recommended act, but maybe the minimum which is expected from the believers is to do at least one khatm during the holy month of Ramadan and continue to have this connection with this noble book after the holy month of Ramadan. As I mentioned again, many people, unfortunately, right from the day of Eid al-Fitr, they forget about everything. They forget about paying charity, about Salatul Layl, about reciting the Quran, and so on and so forth.
But Sheikh, this recitation of the Quran is very, this is what I understood from the actually text of Hadith, from the tongue of the Hadith, or the language of the Hadith, that a person who does not recite 50 verses of the day will be included in the circle of ignorance, if I'm not mistaken, and the Hadith goes well here. So we have to take refuge to God subhanahu wa ta'ala for this. At least we need to oblige ourselves to recite Quran. For as for tahajjud, I have also another point to mention. Is it enough, Shaykh, just to at least practice tahajjud with two rak'ahs, at least slowly, slowly, but later on, inshallah, it will become a habit for us and we shall perform the whole thing, I mean, with 11 rak'ahs?
Yeah, when it comes to tahajjud, I mean, the great scholars, they say that, first of all, it should be done in a gradual way, because we have seen some people that they begin by, for example, doing that for 1 hour or half an hour, but after 1 month, they get tired and exhausted, and they stop doing that altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that it should be gradual. For the first step, people may do that before going to sleep after, Shari midnight. I mean, naturally, between 11, 12 p.m., it is the beginning of Shari midnight, and people can read the Salatul Layl from that time onwards, but it's better to be said before Adhan Asob. So in the first step, some people may do that if they are not able to be to get up before Fajr prayer. But then, as you mentioned, the next step would be just waking up. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe for 1 week or 2 weeks, you just try and practice to be able to wake up.
Very true.
Next, just to make a wudu. I mean, it's been mentioned by some of the scholars. Next, just reading and saying two rak'ah prayer, and gradually you would increase that into 11 rak'ahs. And it's very important to be done gradually and not force our heart to do the recommended action that we are not, inclined toward that. If it is done gradually, we will feel that interest to doing that more and more.
So waking up at that time before Adhan by itself is very important.
Exactly.
And breathing in that atmosphere, in the environment, actually by itself is actually influential in the human beings. But better to recite two rak'ahs, much more better to recite the whole thing. I mean,
exactly.
11 rak'ahs.
Yes. There are stories, quoted from the great scholars, and they are astonishing, good for the people who are able to practice that. And many scholars of Irfan, they say that without tahajjud, you cannot continue treading the path of spirituality.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Actually, up until now, you have given us and told us some recommendations on how to keep our connections with the whole month of Ramadan. One, with regard to tahajjud and staying awake before the Fajr, and second, having a constant program for recitation of the Holy Quran, and now we are listening to the rest.
You know, there are many things to learn from the holy month of Ramadan. As I mentioned, the best action is to be away from forbidden acts, reciting the Quran, doing tahajjud, ikhlas and sincerity is one of the blessings of fasting, repentance, tawbah, increasing the willpower. All these are the great, effects and benefits of the holy month of Ramadan. But how we are able to keep doing them after the holy month of Ramadan? We have a concept in Islamic spirituality based on the narrations, and that is the concept of musharata, muraqaba, and muhasabatun nafs. Quickly, I need to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that we have make reciting the Quran a habit for us during the holy month of Ramadan. I'm talking about a recommended act. You can do that about being away, for example, from backbiting or from telling lies or any other forbidden action. This is an example. We can think of other examples as well.
True.
So after the holy month of Ramadan, I mean, every day early in the morning, we do musharata. We say that, oh Allah, I promise you that today I will recite 50 verses of the Noble Book of Quran.
Mm-hmm.
During the day, we do muraqaba. I mean, we think about that promise. We do that, and every night before going to sleep, we do muhasaba. We think about our actions, whether I was able to act upon that promise, which could be reciting the Quran or being away from backbiting, and so on and so forth. So if we do that, on a daily basis, gradually we'll see great effects, and it could be confirmed and guaranteed.